You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is made in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Over the last few weeks, Labor Day holidays have been celebrated in Western Australia, Victoria and Tasmania, while International Working Women's Day fell on a Sunday this year on March the 8th. Celebrations of class struggle are often overshadowed by public events run by business interests on the same day to disguise the powerful social and political priorities that have put the holidays on the map in the first place. This year, Melbourne took the cake with the municipally inspired bread and circuses event, Moomba, being overtaken by the corporate darling, the Grand Prix, covering up the real reason for the long weekend, which was Labor Day. International Working Women's Day, with its roots in the militant labour movement of the garment workers fighting against sweatshop conditions and pay in 19th century New York, has often been turned into International Women's Day's afternoon teas and business women's networking events. In an attempt to undermine the collective amnesia of the working class of its own history, first up we hear from Sean Scalmer at the launch of his book A Fair Day's Work, The Quest to Win Back Time, and follow up with voices of working class women at the Melbourne International Working Women's Day rally this year.
You're listening to Stick Together, workers' stories and union news. Broadcast around the country every week on the Community Radio Network.
Sean Scalmer's book, A Fair Day's Work, The Quest to Win Back Time, is about the fight for the 8-hour day and so much more. One of the most compelling things for me about the book is the laying out of the basic belief structures of business interests which the workers were pushing against while fighting for fair. Ideas that seem shocking but are still able to be seen in the arguments put forward by business interests today. If we look at the Capitalist Bible, The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, from as far back as 1776, the argument that in the pursuit of private self-interest, the businessman also promoted the general interest, as if propelled by an invisible hand, therefore was unwise to meddle with the decision of capitalists in the hope of social or economic improvement. This ideological framework has a direct lineage to the 1850s Victorian politician who says, "Why should labour be dealt with differently to any other article? If any person entered into an engagement with a contractor, the time he should work and the remuneration he was to receive were matters entirely between the two parties to the agreement." If we go to the late 20th century, we get the Howard-era individual contract push. Different clothes, same dance. All sounds reasonable if you believe that it is the invisible hand of capitalism which naturally arrives at social political order. Perhaps a little bit more disturbing is the discovery that grading of humanness was played out in the fight for fair. Shorter hours are deserved for tradies, but not the less human unskilled. This was seen as reasonable. The historian Sean Scalmer goes into a little bit more detail around why history is important when it comes to a fair day's work.
Like others, I want to begin by acknowledging that we assemble on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people and to pay my respects to their elders past and present. I did imagine the book as a public intervention as well as a contribution to Labor movement debate. So I do just want to briefly do a couple of things. The first of those is to explain why I wrote the book. And the second is to draw out just three insights that I think may be relevant to contemporary struggles. So first off, why write the book? Well, it really comes from two impulses. The first of those was admiration, and the second of those is alarm. The admiration is the admiration for the achievements of the Australian Labor Movement that pioneered the eight-hour day and the winning of a full weekend. That reduced the working week from a standard of 60 hours in the middle of the 19th century to around 40 hours in the middle of the 20th century. That I think is one of the great social movements that defined our society. So, powered by that admiration, I wanted to recapture and recover those campaigns, but not just to narrate them, but to explain why and how they were successful. So that's one impulse that drove the book. The second impulse was alarm, because like others, I've experienced a growing loss of control over working time over the course of my working life. And that has family dimensions. I think about my father, who was a truck driver, who, when I was young, often worked long hours, but always he worked his standard hours and then he worked overtime. And I can recall, you know, us getting a colour TV because he did extra overtime. That was him when he was in his 30s. By the time he was in his 60s, at the end of his working life, he was working as a casual, he was working 55 hours a week. He had lost control over how much he worked because if the work was there, he had to take it. I think about my mother, who was working full-time and juggling elder care because we lived with my grandmother, and the struggle she had to combine both roles, the exhaustion and the emotion. And then I think about my own life, where I've had this wonderful working life, but once wonderful children arrived, the struggle to be a good parent, to be a good worker, and to be a good partner became extremely difficult. So that's just my family experience, and I know looking across that people would have very, very similar experiences, and the social research that's done confirms that. I cite in the book the wonderful research from the Australia Institute, which sadly shows the prevalence of unpaid overtime in our society. Last year, it was 4.1 hours of unpaid overtime every week for a full-time worker. The OECD, of course, ranks the work-life balance across its member states. Across those 38 member states, Australia is seventh last for a work-life balance. So really, the impulse to write the book comes out of that dual consciousness, the admiration for the achievements of winning the weekend and the eight-hour day, combined with alarm of how we've lost the capacity to reduce our working time, apparently. And so what I wanted to do in the book was to trace the struggle over working time from the 19th century through to the present, to explain the successes and also to explain the contemporary challenges in the hope that that could help to contribute in a small way to ongoing struggles. The first finding that I hope is of value to the labour movement is the reminder that nothing is easy, that reducing hours at work, winning back time, has never been easy. This was no uninterrupted forward march. We celebrate justifiably the 21st of April 1856 as stonemasons and other building workers won the eight-hour day, but it's often forgotten that that wasn't then easily extended across the workforce. It took many decades for it to cross barriers of skill, of gender and of race. And equally, it was a very slow progress from a 48-hour week, which is what was won by the stonemasons in 1856, and then the 44-hour week, which won people a half-day holiday on Saturday afternoons. My favourite example of this slow process and difficult process is New South Wales, which in some ways was the pace-setter of the movement for a 44-hour week. In the aftermath of World War I, there were a series of strikes that prompted a royal commission into the possibility of a 44-hour week. A Labor government was in power, and I think, like in the tradition of good royal commissions, they knew what they wanted to find out from this royal commission, which recommended a 44-hour week. And in the aftermath of that royal commission in 1921, they legislated for a 44-hour week for New South Wales workers. But that was then overturned when the Conservatives were elected, and it was rescinded in 1922. Labor argued for it again, won re-election, and reimposed it as a law in 1925. They lost power again, and the Conservatives won power and again removed the 44-hour week legislation in 1930, before Labor finally won power again and reimposed it more permanently from 1931. Now, that's just one example of one state. If you actually looked at the story of how the 44-hour week was won, it's much more complicated across the Commonwealth. And this pattern continued with later decades and later struggles, including for the 40-hour week and the 38-hour week. I think, therefore, an historical perspective on our history of trying to win back time offers a valuable insight. We can't expect easy victories or uninterrupted progress, but neither should we be discouraged when the going gets tough and there are reverses, because that is consistent with our history of the struggle for justice. The second argument that I wanted to make in the book, the second insight, is that there were changing arguments for reduced hours over time, reflecting changed notions of what was fair. So workers never simply said, we want to work less. Rather, they shared and developed sophisticated arguments to justify why we should work less. And I think these arguments actually merit recovery and continued attention, because they have often slipped out of the public sphere. As I say in the book, there were three distinct arguments for a fair day's work that were developed across 175 years. The first of those, an argument for human rights. This said that the worker is a human being, and that as a human being, a worker is endowed with certain capacities. Because we're human, we have the capacity for autonomy and free choice. Because we're human, we have the capacity for learning and for discovery. Because we're human, we have the capacity for self-rule, for participation in self-government. And because we're human, we value social relationships and we want time for family and for friendship. But what workers said in the 19th century was that long hours were preventing the exercise of these capacities, so that they couldn't explore the full range of what it meant to be a human alive. And so the fight for reduced hours was a fight for the humanity of the worker. And that sense of the meaning of that fight galvanised the movement and drew attention across the 19th century. In the 20th century, a new argument began to hold greater sway, and that was an argument based on technology and productivity. Basically, this argument said, well, technology disrupts workers' lives. It creates unemployment, it makes old skills redundant, it often reduces a worker's scope for autonomy and for creativity at work. It also often makes work more unsafe and unhealthy. Workers said, well, if technology disrupts the lives of workers and it generates profits for employers, then workers merit some compensatory reward. And across the 20th century, they said that the benefits of new technology should be shared with employees in the form of reduced time at work. And they argued that this should be especially so because when we work in combination with machines, we get tired, we're fatigued. And when we're fatigued, we work with less productivity, so that if we reduce our hours, we'll actually work with greater efficiency and greater purpose, and the economic costs will not be great. And this argument that technology and productivity justified reduced working hours held sway all the way through into the 1980s. I think it disappeared somewhat from the public's consciousness in the 1980s, but I'm very pleased that, among others, Michelle has brought that argument back in the context of the recent productivity roundtable. The third argument for a fair day's work is based around household labour and gender equality. And really, it's a critique of the narrowness of the movement for an eight-hour day, because the eight-hour day was always built on a fallacy. The idea of 8 hours work, 8 hours recreation and 8 hours rest implied that once you clocked off work, there was no more work to be done at home, no food to prepare, no one to care for, no cleaning or washing to be done. Women led the campaign and led the arguments that household labour and caring work needed to be recognised in our understanding of what work was, and hence in our understanding of what a fair day's work should be. The book tries to recover that advocacy and those arguments that were very present in the 19th century, but were silenced or ignored, but then became more insistent and eventually were heard in the latter part of the 20th century. My conclusion is that these arguments now lay at the centre of our understanding of a fair day's work. However, they haven't been adequately registered or expressed in meaningful institutional change. And that, of course, is one challenge for us as a contemporary movement. The final insight I hope that might be valuable to the contemporary labour movement concerns the means of change, because that's also a preoccupation of the book. What I try and show in the book is that working time has never been reduced through merely persuasive advocacy. No matter how rational, no matter how persuasive you are, that's never going to be enough to oppose the interests of business. Hours have only been reduced when a diverse and committed social movement has made this matter a social and political priority so that it could not be ignored. And the social movement for reduced hours has reached out across culture, industry, and politics. And I try and show in the book the richness of this social movement, the richness of its contribution to culture, the ways in which lectures, essays, poetry, art, including some of the banners in this trades hall, monuments, and of course histories were central to the cultural expression of this social movement, as were popular festivals like the 8-hour day. And what I try and underline in the book is that the memory of past struggles has never been an add-on for the capacity to win back time. It's always been absolutely central. And I hope that this book is in that tradition. Alongside a cultural side, the social movement to win back time has had an industrial side. It inspired the formation of unions. It was a cause of union recruitment and mobilisation, I think as it is today and as I hope it will be in the future. And I try also in the book to show the great creativity that workers showed in the different kinds of action they undertook. Strikes, boycotts, go slows, and sometimes the unilateral regulation of working hours. The insistence that we're only going to work a certain number of hours no matter what. And alongside culture and industrial action, of course, was political action. Public meetings and demonstrations were important to the 8 hours campaign of the middle of the 19th century. So was lobbying, electioneering, and speech making, and they remain important across the 20th century as well. I try and show in the book how legislation also played a role, as well as the deliberate use of the public sector as a pace setter for conditions for the economy as a whole. And my overall finding is that the movement was most successful when campaigners pursued both cultural, industrial, and political struggles together, so that each of them reinforced the other. And what I try and reconstruct in the book is how the combination of these different kinds of struggles, as well as legal interventions, led to the most sustained and powerful gains for workers. The winning of the 8-hour day, the 44-hour week, the 40-hour week, and the 38-hour week. Across the book, I try and treat a fair day's work as an ongoing quest, as a dynamic current in Australian history. And my small hope is that this book is a small contribution to the advancement of this important pursuit.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues. It might come as a surprise to many, but the welfare of women's workers has become even more crucial in the Australian context, with women now forming the greatest amount of union membership at 54%. Since it is unions which form the social and political priorities for workers in the mainstream politics, this year's International Working Women's Rally outside Victoria Trades Hall focused on the voices of organisers and delegates fighting battles for fairer workplaces.
Hello, sisters and comrades. My name is Ana Gamero. I'm a proud Peruvian migrant, a single mom of four, a second almost third year welding apprentice, and a proud AMWU union member. But my journey into welding didn't start in a workshop. It started at an AMWU training night where I was offered an 8-week introduction to welding course. That's where I first met Carney Mann. I don't know where you are, but amazing woman, an incredible union woman who saw something in me before I saw it in myself. She held my hand while I was rebuilding my life after family violence. She supported me with compassion, and she celebrates every one of my wins like they're her own until now. So yes, please, hats off to Court, because this is what union women do. We lift each other, and she surely does. I found welding at a time I was choosing not to just survive, but to build, and I fell in love with it. I love that we take rolled steel and turn it into something strong. Welding gave me independence, it gave me confidence, it showed my children that women belong in overalls and in work sites. Women in trade matter, because when we're present, culture changes, safety improves, and respect grows. being in the trade is not enough. We need to stand in our unions because unions protect us, unions fight for us, for a safe workplace, unions. I've recently stood up on a strike and I've learned something very powerful. When women stand shoulder to shoulder, we are unstoppable. So today, my message is to every woman here, you're not alone. You belong and we are just getting started. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Gail, and I feel incredibly privileged to be standing here in front of so many strong, energized people passionately advocating for women and our powerful place in the union movement. I'm a primary school teacher with over 20 years in my profession. I've been the independent education union representative at my current workplace for over 8 years, but I've also spent time in this role in the 1990s when Catholic teachers fought for and rightfully won pay parity with our comrades in the state education sector. Education is an overwhelmingly female-dominated profession, although this gender imbalance is often not reflected in the ranks of leadership. For too long, teachers have had to struggle with unrealistic expectations of out-of-hours work and the pressure of having to fix all of society's problems within the hours of 9 and 3:30. It is clear that our employers feel that they can take advantage of our innate nurturing nature and often underestimate our strength and resolve. We are currently heading to the bargaining table to thrash out a new EBA. In Victorian Catholic education, there are over 30 separate employers, which means that there is the potential for 30 differing agreements between staff and their employers, all for doing the same job. The last time we bargained for an agreement in 2022, this overcomplicated system caused a delay of over 2 years, which is unacceptable. Under recent legislative changes, we have had the chance to apply for a single interest agreement, an SIA, meaning one agreement that we're all covered by. Victoria is the only state in Australia in which employers in our sector have not consented to a single agreement. An SIA would force the employers to bargain as one and would give us the right to take protected industrial action if we need to, a right that we currently do not have. We needed to prove in applying for the SIA that over 50% of the employees of each of the 30 employers were in favour of a single agreement. So it's no mean feat. As part of the IEU campaign for a single agreement, I engaged a small group of active unionists in my workplace to build awareness of the campaign. We held information sessions in the staff room during recess and lunchtimes, trying to ensure that we reached as many people as possible. A tricky prospect as time-poor teachers must perform yard duties and prepare for lessons during their breaks and often only have a choice between eating or using the toilet. Multiple times we shared electronic links to a voting page and carried around paper copies ready for people to sign. Working together, building interest and awareness and excitement, we were able to get at my workplace, 96% of members and non-members at our school to sign a statement of support for a single agreement. Across the state of Victoria, the IEU gained enough signatures to prove that a majority, 57% of employees, are in support of this. It's now up to the Victorian Catholic Education Authority not to continue throwing up roadblocks and distractions in the hopes of duping Catholic education staff. They should understand that we will not rest until the single agreement is in place and the scales are evenly balanced.
I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're gathering on today, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And I'd like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal people here with us today. My name's Adele Welsh, and I'm a very proud ASU member and delegate, and I've also got the incredible privilege of representing our members on the ASU branch exec. I'm also a difficult woman. Yeah. Where are the other difficult women in the crowd today. In 2012, after years of campaigning, our members in social and community services won pay rises of 19 to 45% for social and community workers across Australia. They said, we all know who they are, they said we'd never win and that the campaign was too ambitious, it was too expensive, and we wouldn't win it. But guess what? We stood together, we campaigned, and we proved them wrong. And today we're doing it again. Because the vitally important work that social and community services workers do is being undervalued. Last year, the Fair Work Commission even proposed to cut the wages of the sector. Yeah. These workers help women and children living with or fleeing from violence. They support people who are living with homelessness or disabilities or mental health issues. They work in Aboriginal community organisations and they support and counsel people in the aftermath of catastrophic events. This is skilled, qualified, professional, and it's essential work. And it deserves to be valued. Our Skilled, Respected and Equal campaign is building power in workplaces and organising across the country to build a really long campaign that we will win. We know that community services workers don't walk away from a challenge, especially when their communities are under attack. We won before and we can win again. And your solidarity matters so much to us. So please stand with us and help us to make sure that the workers who support the most marginalised and disadvantaged communities in our country are finally respected and recognised and paid what they are worth. We know that when we stand together, we make the impossible come true. We proved it in 2012 and we'll prove it again. We will fight any pay cuts. And not only that, we will win pay increases. So we're going to show them right now that we mean business. I'm going to say union, you're going to say power. Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Women!
Power!
Women!
Power!
Women!
Power!
Women!
Power!
Women!
Power!
Women!
Stand, divided we fall, for every dime they give us, a battle must be fought. So working people, use your power, the key to liberty. Don't support that rich man style of luxury.
And there ain't no way they can ever keep us down, oh no. Ain't no way they can ever keep us down.
We won't be bought, we won't be sold, to be treated right, well that's our goal.
And there ain't no way ever keep us down.
We've been shot, we've been jailed, Lord, it's a sin. Women and little children stood right by the men. But we've got a union contract that keeps the worker free, and I'll never shoot that union out of me.
They'll never shoot that union out of me, oh no. Never shoot that union out of me.
Got a contract in our hand signed by the blood of honest men,
and they'll never shoot that union out of me. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.